This is Circulating Ideas. I'm Steve Thomas. My guest today is Susan Alteri. She's the curator at the Baldwin Library of Historical Children's Literature at the University of Florida. You can find them online at cms.uflib.ufl.edu/Baldwin. All right, Susan, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
You are the curator at the Baldwin Library of Historical Children's Literature at the University of Florida. And how long have you been in that position?
I've been the curator here at UF for just over 3 years, so since April of 2012.
And can you tell the listeners, sort of just in basic terms, what the library is and what kind of the stuff they collect?
Sure. The Baldwin Library is a collection solely of children's literature from the 1660s up through present day. And we have over about 100,000 books in the collection. It's a special collection due to the rare materials that are in the collection. And it's open for the public, for researchers, students to use. And we don't sort of operate like a formal library in the sense you can't really go into the stacks or check out our materials, but you can come in and see them and work with them.
And to the public or just to students and researchers?
To the public as well.
Okay.
UF is a public institution, so all our libraries are open to the public.
And can you tell the listeners who Ruth Baldwin was?
Yes, so Ruth Baldwin was the... She was the initial curator, and actually it was her personal collection. She earned her PhD in library science from the University of Illinois, and she worked for many years in California and also at Louisiana State University. And during her time as a librarian, she was collecting children's books from England and from the United States. Her parents were also sending her stuff as well. Her father was, a Shakespeare scholar. And she amassed this collection, this private collection of about 35,000 children's literature texts. And they were all in her house in Louisiana. And I'm sure you can imagine that Louisiana is not a great climate for books. It's humid and hot.
Yeah, a little damp.
A little damp. So is Florida. So these were just in her house. And one of the professors at UF, one of the English professors, Joy Anderson, came to visit or was speaking at Louisiana State and met with Ruth Baldwin and got to see this amazing collection. And then Dr. Anderson came back to UF and talked to the libraries and said, you know, we really need to get this this really amazing collection. And that was late in the very late 70s. And they were, the children's literature field as a field of scholarship was also emerging. And UF was sort of starting to be at the forefront of that. And so there was sort of a nice connection there. So the libraries and the English department went down to see the full collection and sort of get an idea and talk with Dr. Baldwin about it, and she decided to donate the entire collection to the University of Florida. And then she also was the initial curator, so she came here with her collection, and then she continued to build it through most of the 80s. The collection officially opened in 1982, and then she did not retire until 1988.
How many other curators have there been before you?
Just Ruth and Rita Smith.
Okay.
So, yep.
And you talked a little bit about how many items are in there, but what kind of items are in there? What is the specialty of it? Obviously, children's literature is a huge thing. So, what kind of stuff do you specialize in?
Yeah. So we specialize in having comparative editions is one of the Baldwin's really strong suits. So. For example, we have over 450 different editions of Robinson Crusoe. over, I think, between 200 and 300 different editions of Alice's Adventures in Wonderland. We have a comprehensive collection of American and British fiction, nonfiction, and educational texts from the late 18th and throughout the 19th century. We probably have the most of any collection in the United States. So it's just this really amazing collection, and it's got a little bit of everything. So you have, you know, first editions, you know, first edition Alice in Wonderland, and these really, these sort of treasure classic texts. And then you also have, you know, texts that were just very, I'm trying to find the right word. I want to say popular, but more in the sense of, because Alice in Wonderland was very popular, but more in the sense of sort of an ephemeral nature. Sort of cheap tracks and those types of things that would have been printed that really weren't meant to last for, you know, as long as they have. And so you have, I always tell people, you have the great, you know, the good, the bad, and the downright ugly in there.
And do you continue to purchase like new editions of these things? Like when a new edition of Robinson Crusoe or Alice's Adventures come out, do you buy those, or is it a historical more collection?
It's more of a historical collection. We do, I do collect contemporary materials. So the award winners and also sort of trends in children's literature. So things that may be, you know, really popular, like The Hunger Games or those types of things, because eventually those will be historical texts. But the bulk of the collection is really historical. And so I purchase, if, you know, a Robinson Crusoe edition comes on the market that we don't have, I will purchase that. And it could be, you know, something that was recently published, or it could be something that was published in the late 18th or 19th century. And it's just an edition we don't have.
Curious about how that works, because I've never really gotten into special collections kind of stuff before. How are you looking for those things? Are you looking at like auction catalogs? Are you looking at eBay? How do you find editions like that?
A little bit of everything, which is sort of the fun part about when you're working with rare books or with special collections types of materials, because now with, of course, the internet, it's just sort of everybody sort of has things. I'm always really surprised at what I can find. So eBay can work. And then also I work a lot with a book dealer. So catalogs, not as much with auction houses, because that can be a little bit difficult in terms of, you know, because they want the money right away. And so you often can't, right. The university, you know, can't do that. But a lot of book dealers in, you know, on the East Coast and the West Coast, and then also, you know, local ones as well. And it's a nice sort of community, because they kind of know what you're interested in, and you kind of know what they types of things they have. And so, you know, they look out for some things that they think we might be interested in. And then, you know, I comb catalogs and those types of things as well.
It's on the site that you collect Little Golden Books. And I know I've got, I don't even know how many they've published of those, because I know there's on my kids' shelves of stuff that I had when I was a kid.
Right.
We have like 4 shelves worth. And I know there's just so many of those.
Yeah, there's so many. And they're so, yeah, I love the Little Golden Books. And that's the other way we get things, is also donations from people, things they read as a child, or things they purchased for their children, and then, you know, their children don't want them anymore, which I love a lot because we have this wonderful collection of books that, you know, we call them well-loved, you know, but books that kids used. And so people get to see sort of the wear and tear of a book that a kid really enjoyed and loved. That's one of my favorite parts of the collection.
You also have some other ephemera kind of stuff. You said, talked about, there's also like board games and puzzles and toys. Where did that kind of stuff come from?
That stuff usually comes from donations. And it's nice here in our department. We also have a popular culture collection. So I work very closely with Jim Liversich, who's the curator of popular culture, as well as our performing arts collection. And so sometimes he gets stuff and we, you know, we sort of take a look at some of it together. And then, you know, I take donations in of board games. those tend to be more 20th century, older board games or different types of games. You know, they go back to the 19th century, probably even before that. But the ones from the 19th century are, if they're intact, they're very, very expensive. Because sort of the nature of board games, you know, things get lost and they're just not saved. So most of ours are from the 20th century, but I have sort of one of my favorite games was Clue, and I have sort of the quote unquote first edition, if you will, of Clue. And it's interesting to me to just sort of see how what they did when they first marketed it.
Listen to another podcast that I'll include a link in the show notes to this if people want to listen to it, but it's all about like the history of Monopoly, and it has like a completely crazy history of how it became an actual game and went to different countries and came back, and it just it was really interesting.
The games have just these really interesting histories, and I'm always slightly fascinated, and then of course the, you know, all the sort of marketing around them is always really interesting to me.
Those games and things that's come from donations, was that not, that wasn't part of Ruth Baldwin's initial collection?
No, okay. It wasn't really part of her initial collection. She was very more focused on books specifically, although she herself did collect sort of children's ephemera, but not really games as much. I'm not really sure why, so we have a lot of sort of artwork and figurines and just different types of material for children that I guess would be considered more, you know, they weren't books, so to speak.
Is there a lot of research done on campus? I mean, is that still a big, you used to talk about when they first got the collection that it was a big focus for the university in the late 70s. Is that still a big focus in the English department for children's literature?
Yes, it is. It's, they have one of, I think the top children's literature programs still in the United States. And so, they always have a group of graduate students who are earning PhDs in children, you know, with a children's literature specific focus. And they always offer at least three or four children's literature specific courses for students here, undergraduates and graduates. And then they also do a lot of teaching with the collection and with children's literature and sort of the general survey courses of, you know, American literature or British literature as well. So I have very close contact with the Department of English and they with me. And one of my favorite parts of my job is sort of working with the graduate students and the undergraduate students having them bring their classes in or having students, you know, sort of work with these materials because most undergraduates, they're not necessarily, I know I wasn't when I was an undergraduate, exposed to special collections until they get to the university, and sometimes maybe not even then. And so I always have a lot of enjoyment in working with the students and having them get excited over some of these books and these historical texts that we have.
To the classes, or do they usually come in to see the collection themselves?
Both. So, yeah, a lot of the courses will come in sort of for a one-off session where I pull either materials very specific to that class, or I pull just sort of general materials and explain the different ways people work with them. And then I always have them, I try not to talk too much because I find the tactile experience is really important. So I like them to sort of get up and work with the books and sort of, you know, it sounds kind of creepy, but touch the books. They get a sense of the different types of printing and paper and those types of things. And then I also especially the children's literature specific courses, they will allow them an option to do sort of a research paper using the Baldwin or materials from the Baldwin. And so then I try and work with those students on a one-on-one basis.
Of outside researchers coming in to look at the collection as well?
Yes, we do. I'm working to get more, but we have quite a nice community of scholars, both in the United States and internationally as well. So I get people from all over the U.S. as well as from Great Britain and Canada. And as one of the largest collections of children's literature, in particular historical children's literature, there are a lot of materials that we may be the only library or institution that has those materials that they can come in and look at. And so it's quite a nice group of people. And it's nice because the children's literature scholarship field is quite large, but not so large that, you know, you sort of get to know people, and people tend to, you know, go somewhere to do research and then we'll come back as they continue working on something else.
And what kind of research is done with a collection like that?
We have researchers who research all sorts of things. So one of the most recent researchers I've had came from the University of South Carolina. And she was asked to research for a colloquium, depictions of the South in children's literature. And so she decided to focus on cotton and how cotton was portrayed either in illustrations or in text, because some of the older sort of early 19th century books did not have a lot of illustrations. And so I was able to pull about 50 different books from sort of the 19th through the 20th century on how cotton in the South was depicted in children's literature. Another person we had, Dr. Alan Rausch, come and visit looking at 18th and 19th century science materials for children. So how, you know, things like chemistry were sort of portrayed for children, or biology, particularly during the 19th century as industrialization grew. So a lot of different topics.
Yeah, no, that sounds really neat.
Yeah, that was a really interesting one, though. The science one was really interesting. I didn't realize we had so many books on science.
Well, that's neat, too, when you can find things in your own collection that you didn't realize were there.
Yeah, I love that, too, because it's, you know, collections, they get big and unwieldy, and then somebody asks you, well, do you have X? And you're like, oh, I don't know. And that's always nice to sort of learn more about your collection, too.
So I assume with all rare materials like this, you guys are having to do a lot of original cataloging, too?
Yes, that is correct. So there is a lot of original cataloging going on. I know the two catalogers that I work closely with, I do not catalog. I don't have a very strong background in that besides the one class I was required to take.
That's me too.
Yeah, exactly. So, but I have two wonderful catalogers, David Van Cleek and Allison Odell, and they do original cataloging for the Baldwin, and they also add, I learned this this year, genre terms to the Baldwin Library's holdings, the rare book genre terms, which is really nice for researchers to be able to use.
Yeah, I mean, that can help you when you're doing searches for the collection for people when they come in. And you're
right.
In,
yeah.
To understand how it's cataloged. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a great help, and you know, to be able to know sort of if something's a fairy tale or sort of instructional book, you know, those types of things. Yeah, it's hugely beneficial.
And the Association for Library Service to Children has a fellowship set up, the Bechtel Fellowship. Can you talk about that some?
Yeah, the Association of Library Services for Children at ALA hosts a Bechtel Fellowship every year at the Baldwin to either one or two mid-career sort of librarians who don't work at academic institutions. So public librarians or school librarians, special librarians. Well, you get the idea. To come and do research with the Baldwin for a month. And it's sort of a bit like a residency. And so they stay in Gainesville and they work with the materials for a month, and they have myself, and then also Dr. John Check is involved. He's sort of the faculty mentor for them to sort of talk about their research and get ideas. And then they have the opportunity to publish their work in Children and Libraries. I think the last three or four people have done that, and it's always wonderful to just see their articles and have them talk about sort of the process that they went through. It's a great opportunity for people to get to work with these types of materials that might not normally be able to, and so the fellowship is an award to sort of offset some of the costs of staying in Gainesville for a month.
That's neat, and I assume you end up working with them quite a bit during their fellowship.
Yeah.
Or are they more self-sufficient? Or
It varies. Some people are very self-sufficient with their research, and some people they're self-sufficient with their research, but the collection sometimes is so can be so unwieldy and large, depending on their topic, that they get a bit. Everybody does, including myself, daunted, so to speak, and then we sit down and we're like, okay, how do we tackle this? You know, because it's very easy to get distracted or go off and say, oh, what are these books over here? You know, and so there's usually a meeting and a series of meetings that we have about, you know, how to sort of tackle looking at books in the Baldwin. I love working with the fellows who have come. They have such great ideas, and they look at the collection in such different ways. They find the most interesting books. Probably being librarians, they've got a bit of a knack for that. But I know one of our most recent fellow, she did an article on fairy tales and science. And she came in, interested in looking at science education. And then there were a few books in the 19th century that were sort of educated children about science using fairies. In the sort of narrative structure of a fairy tale. And which I didn't even know, she found these and she got really sort of captivated by them. And that was just really great to see. It was just really great for her to find those books and for me to even have the opportunity to see them, but then to sort of make those kind of connections between sort of fiction and then, science, which we think of as, of course, very nonfiction oriented.
Yeah, no, that's really neat.
Yeah.
What kind of digitization efforts are you guys working on to get this stuff? I know it's always hard when you have rare items that you can't touch, but you want to make more available to people.
Yeah, it is. It's the age old issue of preservation versus access, which I'm sure you and I and others have heard a lot about in library science school and whatnot. But yeah. We have a very large-scale digitization program, not just for the Baldwin, but for the university. So we have a department in the library, our digital production services, and they turn our collections, special collections, and other types of material we have into these great open-access digital collections. And so the Baldwin, before I came here, already really had a large digital collection. It's now just over 6,000 items or titles, I guess, in the digital collection. All of those are sort of pre-1923, so they're all in the public domain. So that collection is really more historical. And it is, like I said, full text collection of books that were written for children, all sorts of types of materials. And so since I've been here and came in 2012, we have digitized some of the Grimm Brothers fairy tales, including the first English edition. And I'm working right now on a grant from the American Libraries Association, the Carnegie Whitney Grant, to create our annotated bibliography of 200 science books that were written for children by women during the 18th and 19th centuries. And we're also incorporating at our own cost the links to those 200 books. So we will digitize them and have the full text available as well if people are interested in actually looking at the text themselves. And then we, the Baldwin in the past has had three or four NEH grants, National Endowment for the Humanities. Initially, the first grant was for cataloging and microfilm, but that was right about the time, sort of the infancy of digital collections. So then the next grant was for digitization and cataloging of the collection, and that's how the digital collection was built. And we just put in a new submission, a proposal to the NEH to digitize early American and early British children's literature, so from 1668 to 1823.
Noticed on your site that you've done some exhibits in the past, digital and physical. Do you have any of those planned for coming up?
Yeah, we have an exhibit coming up in November, which I'm very excited about. You'll start to see a trend here between the Bechtel Fellow and Dr. Rausch and all that. So we are going to do an exhibit based off of the work I'm doing with the Carnegie Whitney Grant, and it's going to be on women-authored science books for children. It's called Subverting the Natural Order, and there's a couple really nice things about that exhibit that we're sort of able to show. You know, one is obvious, the women's contribution to science education, but we're also able to show some of the different techniques women writers used to publish books. Whether it was publishing anonymously or using initials, those different types of things. So it's a really nice exhibit to sort of show, you know, for women's studies, for English as well, and just to, you know, sort of show people the different types of materials we have in the Baldwin. So that exhibit's coming up, and I'm very excited about that and have been working very hard with our exhibits coordinator to get that set up. So,
yeah, I imagine that's not easy work to do. So.
No, it's not. And thank goodness we have her, Lourdes, to do our exhibits curation because, and work. I don't know how she does it, but yeah, I've been working on this exhibit for almost a year. And so it's a lot more work than people think it is.
And can you talk a little bit about the speaker series that you have? Do you have anybody coming up on that?
We do. We don't. We're going to have a speaker for the exhibit that we're still hoping to sort of nail down and get a time to talk about sort of the history of science, Dr. Betty Smokovitis. And in the spring, we're going to have Leslie Newman, who wrote the October Morning, the most recent book about Matthew Shepard. And she's also written Heather Has Two Mommies and just a host of other really great children's literature texts. And she's going to come onto campus in the spring. And so I'm really excited about both of those speakers. And we do the speaker series at least once a year. So to sort of, you know, keep up the profile of the library, but also we have the opportunity to bring in these really great speakers, you know, authors and scholars to, you know, talk to the public and to students, you know, about different things. And a lot of them, particularly the authors, they're quite generous. They will do like a master class for, you know, the students as well as a public event, which is always really nice.
Way of raising the profile of the library as well, let people know it's there, yeah. What's available.
I love to let people know that we're here, that we're available, you know, and that we are, you know, that we are open to the public and that, you know, they can't take out the books or anything like that, but they can come and they can, you know, look at things and or come in for a tour. You know, they can bring their kids and everything. I think that's really important for special collections to do to sort of break down some of those sort of natural barriers you have because of the nature of the type of material that, you know, it's rare and so it can't circulate. But to get people in there and to sort of see these things.
Yeah, and sometimes you need an event like that to get the word out outside of, I mean, because you get the research community that kind of knows about this stuff, but you want to get it out to the non, I know Gainesville is a big college town, and most people there are college related, but people who live there who are not college related or in the area or somewhere else in Northwest Florida. So
yeah, I find that really important. And you know, a lot Gainesville is like you said, a college town, and so a lot of people are associated in some way with the university. But there's a fair number of people who aren't, and you know, and I'm also a big believer too. And you know, the younger you get, you know, people interested and can see and handle this type of material, you know, the more chance they might be willing and able to use it sort of later on in their life, you know, when they go to university or something like that. So,
yeah, and all of you listeners, when you're going to Disney World, you can stop at Gainesville on your way.
That's
go
right.
Visit the library.
Visit the library. You know, it's a quick stop. I think that's absolutely true.
We're right off 75.
Right off I-75. We're only about 2 hours away from Orlando, so it's, you know, a good rest to have there on your way. But yeah, absolutely.
Do you think you're going to go to the ALA conference next year that's in Orlando?
Oh yeah, I will definitely be there. I'll be at ALA and at the Rare Books and Manuscript conference as well, which is, I think, right before ALA. They're going to be in Miami though.
Okay.
So, yeah. But yeah, definitely I will be at ALA in Orlando. I go to ALA every year. I love going to the ALA conferences. You know, I see friends from all over, you know, back when I used to work in Michigan, and it's one of my favorite conferences.
Well, the last thing I wanted to ask you about is, this may be a thing of like, they're all your children kind of thing, but do you have a favorite item in the collection or items?
Yeah, it is hard. And you know, it changes very often, all the time. I have to say, though, one of the items that I always come back to, I have two. And one is a portfolio. It's called the Peter Pan portfolio, and it was published. And it's these, it's like an elephant folio, so it's quite large. Illustrations that Arthur Rackham did for Peter Pan, J.M. Barrie's Peter Pan in the 19th century. And I'll send along a picture or a couple pictures for you, but they're just really gorgeous. You know, he made paintings, watercolor paintings, and you know, what he was able to do was just really beautiful. So I love looking at that. I could look at it all day. And another one is, we have a late 19th century, it's called the Speaking Picture Book. And it's sort of a precursor to Speak and Says that I think, you know, we all grew up with. And so it's quite thick, but it's very light because most of it is the mechanics of making animal sounds. And, you know, you pull the strings and the sounds are really quite realistic. And it's just fascinating to me to think how they managed to get something like that to work in the late 19th century.
Fascinating to think that it still works.
I know, yeah. We're starting to lose some of them, but it does still work. So yeah, it's one of my favorite things to sort of bring out and show people, yeah.
All right. Well, Susan, thank you so much for talking to me for the show. And I hope
everybody
learned about the library and want to go down and visit, especially on your way. If you're going to ALA, if you're driving, if you can stop in there and
yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Come down and visit on your way to ALA or after. We have an airport as well. It's not very big, though.
but you can fly straight in.
Right. Exactly.
All right. Well, thank you so much. And where can people go to find out more information about the library?
People can go to our website, which is cms.uflib.ufl.edu/Baldwin. People can also email me at salteri@ufl.edu if they want more information. I'm always happy to email or talk to people. Those are probably the two best ways.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
If you'd like to learn more about the show or listen to past episodes, you can visit circulatingideas.com or follow us on Twitter at CircIdeas. We're also on Tumblr at circulatingideas.tumblr.com, or you can like us on Facebook at facebook.com/circulatingideas. If you have comments, questions, or suggestions for future interviews, you can drop us a line at mail@circulatingideas.com. Music is by Pamela Klicka. Thank you for listening, and keep circulating the ideas. You guys are fancy. You got a Wikipedia page, even. So.
I know. A good friend of mine.
I don't know how good it is, but.
It's pretty good.
Okay, good.
A friend of mine did it. Yeah, Lori Taylor. She does a lot of Wikipedia entries on everything. So.
Oh, great. Yeah, no, it's good to have a person that's
yeah,
good exactly. And keeps that kind of thing up. So.
Right. It's very difficult. I tried to do it, and I thought, I can't. This is too much work.
Yeah, and then luckily, I think it's not high profile enough that people will go and mess around with it.
Right, exactly. Yeah.